Gary's course in quantum chemistry. What other course did I take? I can't remember in chemistry. I took two physics courses. I took the physics lab, what did they call it, the EKA lab or something? Ernest something Adams lab, isn't it? Ernest Kempton Adams Laboratory. It was a graduate course in physics lab. It was a very good course from some point of view. And I have one criticism of it, which I'll tell you about. It was taught by a woman, which is unusual. What was her name? She was the wife of Kerlmeyer, who was a professor. And she went by her maiden name, though. She didn't go under the name of Kerlmeyer. She was very nice. She was interested in spectroscopy. What was her name? Her maiden name, I can't think of. And my objection to the course, it was a very good course. It had all sorts of really informative experiments in spectroscopy and vacuum tubes. We did the milk and oil drop experiment. And Zeeman effect. We did really interesting experiments. But she set up all the apparatus and you were not allowed to touch it. Except when we fooled around with vacuum tubes, we had a breadboard, you know. Mm-hmm. But when it came to using, they had a Hilger spectrophotometer. And we weren't allowed to touch it. And similarly, she had an infrared spectrometer. We weren't allowed to touch that either. At any rate, it was, except for the fact that I can understand her not wanting us to touch it. On the other hand, I don't think that's the best way to teach people how to do experiments. And I took a course in electromagnetic theory in the physics department that was taught by Quimby.
I'm sorry?
Quimby. In addition to being a professor of physics, he was a mathematician. So he looked at an equation and say, now you do a three-card trick. but I'm sure that I took another chemistry course, and I can't remember what it was. Well, couldn't have made much of an impression on me if I don't remember it. And at the end of that semester, I took the qualifying examination. And to this day, I'm sure that I flunked organic, but they passed me anyhow.
At what point did you run into Mary Caldwell?
When I came back and decided to enroll as a PhD candidate in the chemistry department, she was the advisor to the graduate students. And so I went to see her. I should tell you that they had a way of grading. Some people gave A, B, and C, but some people just gave pass and fail. So in some courses, I really didn't know my grades. But I had assumed that my grades were all right because of the fact that they had given me a master's degree without demanding an examination. At any rate, she looked at my record, and apparently these pass and fail grades, she actually had a numerical grade or something for it. And she never told me what it was, but she said, looking at my record, she didn't really think it was advisable for me to go on to complete, to be a PhD candidate. So, since it was, she was putting it at my discretion whether I wanted to or not, I said I thought I would. But I, after all, I was paying my own way, and so they had no objection to my continuing, but that was her advice to me. And I think I told you that I later got the phone to someone I knew who had come 10 years later, and she said the same thing to her. So, she was the only woman on the faculty of the chemistry department. And she, of course, worked in Sherman's domain as a food chemist.
Was Sherman still chairman at that time?
Yes, I think so. I'm pretty sure he was chairman. I can't remember who was chairman when I first got there. No, he wasn't chairman when I first, you know, 31, 32.
Oh.
Was there a man called Morgan? Physical chemist?
That I don't know.
I'm not sure, but I know that when I came back, he was chairman. He was chairman. And the scuttlebutt was among the students that they couldn't agree on anyone of the stars in the department. So they chose chairman as being unobjectionable.
That was generally true. Although I think he'd been chairman for some time.
Had he?
Yeah, and there may have been some interim period in which he wasn't chairman, but
I'm not sure. I just don't know. Well, when you're first year graduate student, you're not very aware of these things anymore.
What about choosing a research director?
Oh yes,
I have
long since decided that I want to work with Yuri, and then he got the Nobel Prize that year.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to see him. Just about the time, I don't know whether it was just before I took my qualifying or after, and told him that I want to do my graduate thesis with him. And he said, you don't want to do my graduate student. I don't pay any attention to my graduate student. So I said, that's all right. I still want to be your graduate student. And it was true, by the way. But he had told me. So I decided, as I say, that I wanted to work with him. And I had always been interested in physical chemistry anyhow. And most of the courses I took, first of all, I took several physics courses, and I took, I guess, most of the physical chemistry courses they gave.
Could you have some math beyond the calculus course?
Oh, yes. That's another course I was taking, of course. I was taking function theory of complex variables in the math department. I don't remember when I took that. But I did take that. I sort of, I don't know, sort of learned differential equations, so I don't know how, but I did kind of know it. But I did take that function theory and complex variable, which was a useful course if you were going on to physics and physical chemistry. And I got to know my husband. He was a students in that lab course that he had with what is her name? I can just picture her, I can't think of her right now. And he was, of course, a fantastic student. He got straight A's in everything. Physics and math is all. He was an undergraduate. He was taking graduate courses. This was his senior year. And as I say, he got straight A's all the time. They gave him a master's degree at the same time that they gave him a bachelor's, because he's taking so many graduate courses. And he took mathematics as much as he did physics, so he knew a lot of math.
I was just looking at his entry in American Men and Women of Science, and I noticed he took a master's degree at Columbia, and then he went to Princeton, but then he took his PhD at NYU.
Mm-hmm. The reason was, he went to Princeton, and in those days, getting into Princeton was equivalent to getting a scholarship. They had very few graduate students. The total number of graduate students in all fields was limited to whatever the graduate college could accommodate. I forgot whether it was 100 or 200. This is, you know, all the way from physics to archaeology. And the tuition was only $100. So it was equivalent to getting a scholarship. But my husband had enough money. He wasn't my husband then, by the way. He had enough money for 1 year at Princeton. And then he tried to get a fellowship. And he didn't get it. They gave one in theoretical. He was going to be a theoretical physicist. They gave one, and although he was the least vain of any man I've ever known, in later years he said they did make a mistake. They gave it to someone who really didn't ever do anything in the medical business. So he had to get a fellowship somewhere. He couldn't stay at Princeton, couldn't afford it. And he had, one of his professors was Ed Condon. And Ed Condon thought very well of him, and he was a friend of, what was the name of the man who was head of physics at NYU, this is Uptown NYU. He later became head of the department in Indiana. He left NYU. Well, I don't remember either, but he wrote him a letter saying, look, we have this very good graduate student, and he needs a fellowship. I recommend him highly to you, and they gave him a fellowship. So that's why he went to NYU.
Okay.
Anyhow, I stayed at Columbia, and I again had no support. No financial support whatsoever. The teaching assistants at that time got $700 a year. With one or two exceptions, they had people who worked twice as much as the others, and they got twice as much money. But there were only one or two of them. And there was one university fellowship, and that went to, as I mentioned to you,
okay.
T. Iowa Taylor. Yes. And for good reason, he had shown his ability to do research. He had two papers published in the JACS before he ever came to Columbia. And he was a very good experimentalist, really very good, but he wasn't a particularly fast thinker. Now, Urey, on the other hand, I've worked with many of the greats. Almost everyone I've ever worked with is a Nobel laureate. But of them all, Urey had the fastest mind. It was amazing. Once a week, he expected me to tell him what I was doing. And I used to have to prepare myself very carefully, because I'd start on number one and number two, and he was down to number five already by the time I got through telling him about two. So I would think the thing through very carefully. When he and Tuffy used to have a conversation, it was like two monologues. They weren't on the same wavelength. But anyhow, but Tuffy was a wonderful experimentalist. He really was. The first thing Urey set me to do was theoretical calculations. My problem was to be the separation of carbon-12 and carbon-13. At that time, Urey was busy separating isotopes.
Yep.
Also, I had some other fellow graduate students who were doing spectroscopy, for example, of methane and deuterated methane, Raman spectra. There was one student doing that. Of all the, you know, CD3H and so on, the whole series, CD4 and all the in between, CD8-4 and CD4. But he wanted me to do that, and in order to, he was using chemical equilibria of isotope reactions that the equilibrium constant which would differ slightly from one, and if you had multiple plates, that's how you enrich one isotope. It was always a two-phase reaction, so that you would enrich in one phase and deplete in the other phase. So first he had me do theoretical calculations, starting with spectroscopic data and getting equilibrium constants from partition functions. Even though you didn't know the real partition function, you could always calculate the ratio of the isotopic partition function. And you did it as a function of temperature, so you knew which reactions would give you the best fractionation factor, and at what temperature that was true. Well, after 3 months of such calculations, I came up with the fact that if you could react carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide, you get the highest fractionation factor for carbon-12 and carbon-13 of any of the reactions that he had told me to look into. Sophie told me to, oh, I should tell you, that was the next semester, the first semester, he had me learn how to blow glass. And I had to repeat an experiment that one of his postdocs had done.
I was going to ask you about that because I know in a couple of instances you showed a vac line and you said the tube had to be sealed onto the vac line, and I was wondering who had done that. I take it you had done that. Well,
oh.
Go ahead and tell me about learning how to blow glass.
He said that, true, we had a glass blower at Columbia, but you might be in a place where there was no glass blower, and he thought everyone should know to blow glass. Now, he had a postdoc. His name was Walls, and he came from Illinois. He was a marvelous glass blower, and that fellow taught me how to blow glass. And it was a very useful thing to learn because, you see, we worked in vacuum systems mostly, and we had to set them up ourselves online. And the first problem that he gave me had already been done by a different postdoc. What was the equilibrium constant for 016 and 018 in the reaction of H2O and CO2. And this was done on a vacuum line. You had to have a, what we had was a bank of electrolytic cells which from which you got hydrogen and oxygen. And you used an enriched form in one of them, so that you fed in H2 and O2 at the same proportions as you had in water. And the way you did it is that you let the hydrogen come through a quartz, what shall I call it? It was a capillary tube with an inner capillary tube and an outer tube, and the hydrogen flowed through the inner one and the oxygen flowed through the outer one, and you actually lit it with a flame and you let it burn, and you recombined the hydrogen from one source with the oxygen from another source. Anyhow, this was the particular reaction which I had to study, as I say, was water and CO2. Was it? I don't know. It was something that this fellow had done, this postdoc. In any case, it was just really a practice thing for me to learn how to do experiments. It was not a problem for me, because he had the answer. The question was, would I get the same answer? And eventually I did. I also had to learn how to analyze the deuterium in that in those early days, which they did by a flowed method. The density of water changed enough the pressure, and you had a float in there that was very similar to the density of water. And by adjusting the pressure, you could get it just to float. You looked at it through the eyepiece of a telescope. Anyhow, so first I did this just repeating someone else's work. And there I think that we...
We were describing a float method. Too.
Oh, yes. Yes, the way we analyze the deuterium. You have a float, and you look at it through the crosshairs, and you have it in an ice bath, ice water bath, so the temperature is constant, and you change the pressure, and it will either rise or fall, depending on whether what the pressure is, whether the density of the water is greater or less than that of the float. And by determining the pressure that you needed to get it to float, and move neither up nor down, you knew what the density was, therefore you knew the deuterium content. And that was good to a half part per million.
It seems very crude, but
it isn't crude at all, because the temperature, the pressure, it doesn't change the density much. So you get a big change in pressure for a rather small change in density.
Yes.
But the real difficulty with the method is to have the water pure enough, you see. Mm-hmm. So we have ways of purifying the water.
Cut very, very small amounts of water.
No?
With the water generated through some conversion.
But you see, in chemistry, when I got to biochemistry, we had to use small amounts. But in chemistry, these floats, you needed, several milliliters of water to do it. Now, later methods were gotten needed very much less than that. But that comes later.
Okay.
Well, so that was the year, that was the first thing I did, as I say. I learned how to blow glass. And I repeated this other fellow's work, and I think I got the same answer he did eventually. And I learned how to do deuterium analysis. And then I went back to my job for the summer to earn money. That was the summer of 35. See, I came in September 34 back to Columbia. And, during the year, this was interesting, there was a meeting at Columbia of the Aeronautics Association. So I thought, man, some of the people I knew down there might be there, so I wandered over. And whom should I see but the head of this whole organization who had
booted you out of the laboratory?
That's right. And he greeted me very graciously, and he said, "Miss Cohen, you're a very impressionable young woman, but why don't you get yourself involved teaching at Lindmore College, for example?" So I thanked him, and I said I really wasn't interested in teaching, but I was interested in doing research. But his notion that I could get a job at Greenville College was really naive. Anyhow, he was trying his best to get it up because I was still on leave of absence. I hadn't
That's
resigned
right.
yet. So I went back for the summer and I did some more work, and then I quit. Mm-hmm. I couldn't focus again. Mm-hmm. I was taking another leave of
absence.
So then I quit. And I came back and I started working on this C12, C13 problem. I'm not sure that's when I did the calculations, whether it was before that summer or not, but it was before I started the experiment. And that, of course, depended on analyses on mass spectrometer. And you couldn't use density methods for that. So I tried various ways of making these two gases come to equilibrium. But the mass spectrometer wasn't working. So I worked the whole year in the dark without knowing the results of the same experiments I did.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, when June came around and the mass spectrometer was still not working, Yuri said, this won't do. You go down to Princeton and Blakely will run the samples for you.
Mm-hmm. So this year that Yuri was having the machine built and the fellow was using them
That's
for
right.
us.
Mm-hmm. That was the year that Mosier was the name of the fellow. Was trying to construct a mass spectrometer. He was a student of Neos, and then he had spent a postdoc at Blakely's lab at Princeton. Blakely was probably the outstanding mass spectrometrist in the country at that time. And so I went down there. Yuri called him and asked him if he could do it, and he said yes. And I went down there with all these blasts of gas.
Yes.
Somehow someone took me in the car. I think I'm
I was picturing you getting on the train.
At any rate, it took a day or two to analyze all these samples, and every experiment was negative. I was ready to quit graduate work at that point. But my future husband talked me out of it. And Yuri was very apologetic. He said, "I'll never give a student a problem again, but depends on the instrument that isn't operational again." Well, I had wasted 9 months. So, he had just succeeded in enriching OAT. And there was a paper published on how to analyze water by the falling drop method. It's by the way, I wrote an article on that method, which I gave to Jeff Sturkey on the compound preparation and measurement of isotopes.
Right.
Isotopic traces, I think it's called. It had been published by Krogh and Musing in Copenhagen. They were physiologists. And they had a diagram of the pipette that they used. They used an automatic pipette, and they used a mixture of two organic compounds that were very close to the density of water and were immiscible with water. So the principle of it was that you dropped a drop into the tube, but you had to have a constant temperature bath that was good to the balance of the degree. And you dropped the drop into this tube, and it fell for a certain distance. And in that time, you always dropped it in so that it was colder than the room, so that it would equilibrate and not fall. It kept equilibrating until the density was such that it would fall. A temperature equilibration, I'm talking about. And then it would stop falling slowly, and eventually it would come to temperature equilibrium. And then you had a mark on the tube, an S mark, two places. And you timed the fall, the rate of fall, the drop, the stopwatch.
This is a drop of water falling through
an immiscible liquid.
Okay.
Of density very close to water.
Okay.
And, you constructed a calibration curve. And now that was good to one part for me. It took much less water because the drops were pretty small. They were much larger than the nature. But they were very small. You could do the whole thing several times with 2 tenths of a mil of water. So it was much better than the float method from that point of view.
This for 018 now.
Yes, it's water.
D2O,
yes.
Right?
Now, the objection to it with 018 is that when you purify water for deuterium analysis, you use oxidizing agents. You use alpha permanganate, you use chromic trioxide. You don't introduce any hydrogen. But who knows what you're doing with oxygen?
Right.
You really have to worry about converting, first of all, exchange of these things, and the dilution of your sample. Well, it turned out someone else in the lab was investigating exchange with inorganic anions like permanganate and chromate and so on. And they don't exchange that easily. They do at certain temperatures, but we used to heat them. But anyhow, I had no other method. So, you see, he gave me a problem that I could do with a method other than mass spectrometer. So the first thing I was given to do was to try a lot of organic compounds and see with oxygen in them, and see which ones exchanged with water at a reasonable rate. And it was rather clever that I used, that came later with the mass spectrometer, I guess. Yeah. With the mass spectrometer, I used water that was lighter than normal with a deficit of 018, because you had a much bigger range. You'd only, the normal concentration, normal abundance of 018 is about 2/10%. And he had only concentrated to about 2.5. So at best you had a factor of about 12. But if you went from 2/10 to nothing, you had a tremendous factor. So when I got to using the mass spectrometer, I did practically all my thesis work with water that had been depleted of 018.
I see.
Because it gave a much bigger range.
Okay.